He is Charles Gallant, user experience designer and proponent of prototyping.
Ah, it's true. He is Aubrey Goodman, engineer and connector of cables.
Today, that is certainly true. And this is a lovely little show that we lovingly call Distilled. Today, we are not drinking bourbon. Normally, we do. But given all the party that's been going on here...
Can't drink bourbon every day.
Well, you can, but then you have to justify that or talk to a lawyer. You can find us in a digital dead drop on the side of Market Street next to the ubiquitous coffee shops there that are to be had in downtown San Francisco. Or you can find us on the web at distilledradio.com or iTunes or Podomatic. Just search for Distilled. You can find Charles at Charles Gallant. There are two L's in Gallant. Or myself at Aubrey Goodman, both Twitter. Both how they sound and both sensible names. And
very sensible.
Handles for easy discovery. So this week we're going to talk about user interface design. Not experience design. I'm not going to get into the UX, UI debate because my blood will boil quickly. But we're going to talk about tools that we use. I know this is a crazy thing. It's a technology podcast, and we're actually going to talk about technology for a change.
New leaf.
But we're going to talk about the tools of the trade, as it were, for those of us who do this for a living, which is both of us. So... Yeah, I guess let's start off with prototyping. I mean, you mentioned the O word just a minute ago.
Right. Well, that was OmniGraffle. Yeah. So basically, I love I spend a lot of time in OmniGraffle. But before I get into that, just stepping back a little bit, I don't know about you, but I've seen dozens of services and applications and websites that are trying to be the best rapid prototyping source. I think in like UI design, rapid prototyping is one of those like weird SEO keywords that is just kind of insane at the moment if you look at it. And there's a bunch of different tools that try to do the same thing. I think the first that came around and still one of the best is called DivShot. It's one of these online tools that lets you rapidly create an HTML thing that's interactive and actually outputs nice HTML. But anyway, the reason why I bring these up is that it's important to see them for what they are, which is 9 times out of 10 a pretty sort of empty promise, right? I think at the end of the day, if you're doing quick UI work and you want to be able to move at a reasonable rate, you need a tool that's local, it's on your machine, that can make simple boxes and arrows. You can use it on an airplane, and that it's not overkill. I think it's a natural human urge to look for a tool that will solve more problems that you can. But at the end of the day, I find that the simplest things are the best. It's pen and paper, right? It's whiteboards. It's OmniGraffle is just moving simple boxes around. You know, if you find yourself doing elaborate work in any tool, save, you know, Photoshop or, you know, a coding application where that thing actually needs to come to life, you're probably not moving quickly enough, you know. There's something to be said about keeping designs extremely lo-fi until the very final point where you're actually implementing them. So I suppose the design phase has a huge impact on what tool you use. And for this, I'm speaking, of course, just to the very early phases where everything is quick and agile.
Yeah. So I'm curious, in your experience, you know, we tend to do things very agilely in what we do recently. But I wonder, in your, like, I guess, longer history, have you found that to be a common thing? Do you find there's like a tight iteration loop between product development and product design generally? Or do you think that's just something we do?
I think it's something that every team needs to find out and it needs to find the right balance of. I mean, even if you have a tight... relationship between design and development. That doesn't necessarily mean that design won't spend too much time designing and, you know, development won't spend too much time developing. You know, I think knowing exactly where to put down, Knowing where design ends and development begins is hugely important. It's something that there's no single rule for. You have to talk about it. You have to get people in the same room looking at it, and you have to, you know, just decide on the fly every time. I don't think there's a clear handoff point.
Do you think that's mostly related to the actual makeup of the team, the individuals working together, what they feel comfortable with?
Absolutely. You know, a good example could be, hey, if I'm designing an interface and I know that there's a particular scrollable area that I want to act in a very unique way and have some unique nuances, I might say, you know, hey, go ahead and start building like this basic area, but leave that one door open because, you know, I'm actually going to want to go in and add some variables myself to the way this thing behaves and the amount of elasticity on it or something like that, mm-hmm. right? Or we might say, look, let's plan around. If all I'm building is an app that's like a scrollable feed of content, that scroll is really going to matter. And so let's make sure we budget for an extra week just to look at that one piece, right? You know, so the tools you at use least. Almost don't matter at that point, right? It's you know, it's all about just sort of process and moving at the quickest rate you can. And again, if that means paper and pencil, then so be it. You know, no fancy web service is going to help you with that.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I'm really glad you brought up the paper and pencil thing, because I'm a big fan of sketching. I've done a lot of sketches over my many years of design and engineering. And we talked earlier this week. A coworker of ours asked about a tool. I forget which one. But it doesn't matter. It was basically like, have you used this before? And, you know, what are your thoughts on it generally? And one of the things that it evoked in my response was the collaborative side of things. And, you know, some software systems are really great at allowing one person to make some, say, one wireframe within a larger scope. And then other things are really good at enabling that one wireframe to live in a wire flow in a larger sense, larger architecture, and to interact, you know, like clickable things. You can click between mm-hmm. this and that. Oh, it was InVision. That's what it was.
Yeah.
And so InVision gives you the opportunity to actually publish all of your real-time, you know, sketch
right.
dynamics as an app. And still, it's an HTML, CSS kind of app that lives on a phone.
Right.
But one of the things that that I think pencil and paper does that these other tools, which can be really fancy. I mean, it's like Mockingbird gives you the ability to do multiple editing. Mm-hmm. You can be editing the same sketch that I'm editing, and you know, your yeah. rectangular bounds as you're dragging things around the screen. I see that. But again, if you're on an airplane, unless you have paid the exorbitant $8 per minute, it seems like, for the Wi-Fi yeah. on the plane, you don't have access to that. So now it, you know, those kinds of things limit what you can do in a way. They're giving sure. you these extra tools, but they're also limited.
Yeah.
And I think when it comes to paper and pencil, it forces, there's a certain, I guess, intimacy of design collaboration. That's, we have to be sitting looking at the same piece of paper. We have to be within like 2 meters of each other and talking.
Yeah. Well, like, let's talk about, like, you know, I think you have to look at these things on a case by case basis, and you have to look at it like feature by feature in a way. Like, let's look at just purely the last thing you said, which was collaborative editing, right? Real time editing, right? Now, in a text document, okay, I can sort of see that. Personally, if I'm writing a paragraph of text and someone else is also on that paragraph, that's maddening to me. And
yes.
I actually feel the exact same way about OmniGraffle, right? Spreadsheets, for example, totally, like, I've seen that done before. That can right. actually be very helpful at times. But, you know, to use your point, right, if you're physically sitting next to someone, you have your own body's personal space that right. someone can either be in or not in. And if you want to make an edit to the canvas, you shove that person out of the way, right. and then you are physically the only person who can edit that canvas. That's a really simple way to think about version control,
right.
a very analog way.
Hockey check.
Yeah, exactly. You're checking out the document, right?
So hockey, like, checking out.
Yeah, like, so that. here's like, and, you know, some of the things you mentioned, like publishing, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yes, it's helpful to publish like an interactive clickable thing. you know, but again, I think there's, you know, lo-fi simple solutions that have existed for years that do this. PDFs have links in them. You can export a PDF quite easily that has clickable hotspots that just link you to different areas, you know.
Exactly.
If you're using the built-in editor in OS X or Windows for viewing a PDF, they all will render a single page view and let you click between hotspots on it. That's
right.
You know, I think all too often we look for these tools that'll advertise these crazy amazing things, whereas if you just use the simplest approach you can to let you get from A to B quickly, it's all too often the best solution.
One thing I really like about sketching is that, and I've come from a very long technical documentation, engineering, schematic kind of background. I did a lot of work with CAD and computer-aided design of some form or another, not just architectural documents and electronic schematics, but it's all the whole spectrum. In those cases, like back in the day, which according to Dane Cook was a Wednesday, we used to have to call things out. Like, so you had to bound the scope of an interaction. And I mean the interaction of the designer with the schematic or the engineer with the schematic. So if there was an action that someone was going to take, it had to be explicitly called out with some, annotation that says,
right,
when you tap on this target, this physical space, this rectangular, circular area, whatever it is, this button, when you touch this thing, something is going to happen.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I've spent a lot of time in sort of the interaction design space thinking about is decision gates. So you're prompted with a certain set of information, and sometimes you have other information that you carry with you. I mean, in every case, you always have history. No one ever encounters a situation completely without context. But bounding the context, bounding the scope of the decision that you're prompted to make, like a push notification prompt, for example. If you just prompt this thing, it's like somebody launched the app and there's this weird prompt that says the system needs to send you shit. You're like, yeah, okay, cancel or allow, right? So it's a decision gate. You have to make a choice. You have to take an action. You can't do anything else until you hit the cancel or the okay. But to put that into like a sketch on paper means to distill the experience, that unique individual moment, down to what did you know when you got there? Why are you making the choice? And what are your options? So as a designer, we are faced with essentially a sequence of, or a tree really, of gates where there's context, there's history, and at every moment along the process, there's a choice you have to make. And that choice is bounded by the process itself.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think what's nice about sketching, maybe this is what you were going for, is that, it does take time and it takes planning to and a little bit of discipline, physical exertion, hand-eye coordination,
right,
to commit to these ideas. I think all too often we can have a tool that's great at quickly being able to manifest images, but that extra layer of discipline actually helps, right? Because to physically plan out something that you're talking about, you need to physically plan out how this thing is going to sit on a page and live, right?
Exactly.
You need to plan out where you're going to start drawing. Are you going to start drawing from the bottom right and then move towards the center and smudge everything with your wrist? Or are you going to start drawing from the top left? And
right.
I think little things like that are what always fascinates me about sketching, is because when it comes to articulating a complicated idea, there are many times that the quality and ways that someone decided to sketch a thing, are solely responsible for communicating the essence of that idea. Maybe they took an arrow and they just scribbled over it in extra bold, used a ton of pressure when they were drawing this one arrow on the page, and that was somehow made it more clear that one was different. Whereas if they were using a digital tool, that one arrow may have just been a copy and paste of something else. And they might have,
Yeah. So in the digital world, we have pixels that are in many cases either black or white. But when you're using a 2H pencil versus a 2B pencil, you write with the same pressure, it produces a different strength of, like, or like width of line or whatever.
Yeah,
and I think those things matter quite a lot to the sort of nuance of the experience. So I really want to talk about the other side of this, which is mm-hmm. code-generated UI. So we talked a lot about sketching in the last 15 minutes, but
right.
I want to talk some about the sort of programmatic generation of UI, mm-hmm. which is the other side of the coin, which both of us have lots of experience with. That's a totally different animal, right? I mean,
yeah.
you're interacting at the code level. It's programming things, retrieving things from a list and selecting an item and then populating that into a rectangular space or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, again, it sort of depends on what the goal is or what the context is. I mean, I think the thing that's really valuable about programmatic UI, I can imagine, is that it's a close representation, more often than not, of an abstract computer concept, right? Like an array, for example, right? If I want to render a list of items, right, and I'm in a web view or something, you know, it makes sense to sort of maybe I'm looping through an array in PHP and I'm creating UL and LI elements to create a bulleted mm-hmm. list really, really easily. Like, technically, that's programmatic UI,
mm-hmm.
right? you know, it becomes a representation of the technology itself, which is helpful to visualize, you know? Again, whether or not the goal of that is to, write code and to understand the contents of your array, or if the goal of that is to build a UI to put in front of someone. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there, the merits of it change, right? Depending on what you're going for. But
right.
I think more often than not, there's enough times in, you know, digital interfaces where we've already set the precedent to see something that represents the technology underneath that, you know, creating UI in that way I've just mentioned, for example, simple list of items on a website in like bulleted form, that's becoming very expected, right? So there is tons of precedent there, if that makes sense.
It does, at least to me. Our three listeners may hopefully agree. I don't know.
Yeah.
Hi, folks.
Well, it depends, you know, so well, what I mean, when it comes to using it as a creative process, right? Let's take that, yeah. because that's what we were talking about with sketching. If we're going to compare this to sketching, yeah, we have to say, all right, generating UI via code for the goal of actually synthesizing what is to be a usable interface. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, one thing that I've done a lot early in the process of prototyping and kind of early iteration is to build. I'm a big fan of like the quick and dirty approach. Like, make the simplest template you can. Don't add any visual design at all. Basically, it's a digital representation of the sketch that you made that was a rectangle with an X through it. Oh, that's an image. Or like, oh, you know, here's a rectangle with a little carrot in the corner. Oh, that's a text field.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now we can digitize that, and now we have this rectangular shape. We have some CSS if it's web. We have some XML if it's mobile or what have you. Some digital representation of the layout of that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going to populate that template with data that we pulled out of somewhere. Sometimes that's just like Antonio Banderas, right?
Oh,
or
like
Abraham Lincoln, right?
Placeholder data.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Or like a picture of a kitten.
Right.
You know, which, by the way, placekitten.com, wonderful resource.
Oh, right.
You can just give it placekitten.com/another number. And the first number is the width. The second number is the height.
There you go. It gives
you an image of a kitten with the width and height you ask for.
Right.
In real time. It's wonderful. there's a bunch of those kinds of services. But that kind of placeholder data is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And even, I don't even want, like, we could talk for an hour about just the details, like how you specify what the placeholder data is and how that affects the design.
Right.
For things like internationalization, right?
Mm-hmm.
For German, I'll go on in just a 2-minute thing.
Oh, yeah.
In the case of internationalizing for German, you have to use long words like your placeholder name, for example, like a first and last name. Has to be like long name is long, super, super long, actually long. Like that one word. Because some people's names are really long or some words are really long. So you assume in maybe your local dialect or your local culture that names are short, like Tom or Steve, right? Mm-hmm. But not everybody's name is that short. Mm-hmm. And in our culture, it might be common for names to be a certain length, but in other cultures, it might not be. India, for example, like the classic, what is it, The Simpsons, Apu Nahasapi Mepetalon. Like, that's a lot of characters for a last name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to take these things into consideration when you're doing the design, because you have to, no one likes to see their names in ellipsis.
Right.
Truncate with an ellipsis. So what do you scale the font? You're like, all these things. But I don't want to get too far into the weeds on that point. It's just an interesting aspect of this, which does come out of the sort of digital prototyping thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not often that you write out the whole of a long ass name on paper while you're sketching. Normally you just put like a dot with a dash after it. Like, that's a word,
yeah.
You know, and you just sort of represent text. It's like a simple symbol. You don't even put the text, because it takes a long time to write a name out.
Right.
And what you're doing when you're sketching
block off
is
copy.
Exactly. You're representing things in rectangular space for the purpose of moving forward towards something like a digital design.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like when we use stub data, same thing as which tool we use or which tool we select in the process, that affects the process. So it's sort of like that quantum thing. You can't observe a thing without affecting the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the same sort of philosophy applies here, I think. The tools that you select, the method that you choose for the design process affects the outcome of the design. I find that really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's interesting to think about, like, you know, different ways to get around that name length problem. Because that comes up over and over again, doesn't it? You know, it's just, how much room do I really have for this? I think it'd be nice to see a service that could actually, here I'm talking about web services when I was bashing them earlier, but it'd be interesting to see a way to take a simple UI and just feed in a bunch of random strings so that every time you previewed it, somehow during the design process, it had a different name in it, or it had a different, you know, if you indicated,
so not the same information.
Yeah, if you indicated that like a text field was dynamic and you're working in like Xcode or something, it'd be interesting to be able just to like use a library that like put a flag on that text field. Just every time you compiled your app, it just generated like a different name.
Random length string.
So that you could see at a glance, like, oh, hey, this one time I tested it, it doesn't look right. Because that'll come back to bite you in the end if you don't pay attention to it early, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's funny. But anyway, that's just a random thought.
So I'm curious, and we've talked about injecting data information into a layout, predefined layout. But we haven't really talked about defining the layout itself in code. This is something we've both done a little bit of.
Mm-hmm.
As that applies, I guess, to the larger conversation we've spoken about so far today, how do you feel as a designer, as a like someone who I know prefers visual layout, how does that, like, if you do you feel overly constrained when asked to do things in code?
Well, no, I mean, it depends on the problem that I'm trying to solve. I mean, I think personally, I think as someone who first and foremost is a designer, I think that, you know, what matters is visual emphasis, right? Mm-hmm. And what matters are the hierarchy of information that's on the page, right? And whether it's a view of an app or a view of a screen, you know, usually you want to tell someone about one key idea, right? This is a screen where you do this, or this is a screen where you get information about that,
right?
Or this is a screen where you will choose between two things. Now, you know, sure, there are going to be some screens where having a coded environment is totally necessary. If you're building something with, you know, a bunch of expanding panels or something that slides back and forth, you know, it may be helpful to sort of see that come to life in code sooner than later. But I still believe that for the design process, it's very helpful to at least start with some sort of notion of where it will live on the page and how that layout will be synthesized in a very lo-fi way, because you might want to try, you know, dozens of interpretations of that.
Mm-hmm.
Before you settle on the right thing. And just personally speaking, I can make dozens of OmniGraffle documents in the time it can take me to make, you know, three or four things in code by manipulating X and Y values and widths and rectangular transforms and those things.
Right.
And so
nudging things around until they look right in this different permutation.
Yeah.
Save that, copy it, edit some other stuff.
Exactly.
At the end of an hour, you have a bunch of things that might be viable things.
Exactly. So if I'm solving a visual layout problem, like I've got to have a visual tool to do it, you know, that's why I started all this by saying to what end, you know,
right.
Because if we're trying to actually build it, and if the goal is to get, like, if the end is not necessarily to design it, but if the end is to get something created quickly, totally different ballgame, right?
Right, exactly.
You know, like, if I know it's a simple problem to solve, it's a problem I've solved 100 times before, hell, yeah, I might jump right into code and just create something there. But it's all about the context.
Yeah. We don't have time to really talk about it today, but I would really love to one day talk about the circumstances that lead you to one end or another, why you choose this, in what situation you choose certain things over other things.
And sure.
Because I think that it's the same thing. It's a decision gate.
Mm-hmm.
You, when prompted with a certain circumstance, you, based on the circumstance and your past history and your understanding of your own capabilities, you make a choice.
Yeah. I think
that's all fascinating,
like,
to me.
Totally. The simplest answer that I would give, just like as a non-answer, is that whatever
those are my favorite.
Whatever approach is going to enable you to create more in the time that you have. I think the worst thing that can happen to any sort of designer or person who is trying to create something is the idea of like a writer's block or like a creative block where you don't know what the next step forward is. And so if it's code or layout, whatever tool is going to allow you to keep momentum and actually create things and not stand still is the correct one, because you know, like, you've got to keep moving forward, you know.
Yeah, I like that. Wow, just want to let that sink in for a minute.
It wasn't that profound, yeah.
No, but it is. Right?
We're all sharks.
It's true. There's a certain aspect to it.
Yeah,
that is. It's the same thing. It's like, do you spend 6 months doing a design and you distill that design into a document that you then hand off to someone else to build and they never interact with you? Or do you spend 15 minutes on a sketch and you hand it off to an engineer and they say, fuck this noise, I can't build that. It's going to be, this is great, but I can't, where am I going to get the data for this?
Yep.
And then they pass it back and it becomes a much higher, you know, frequency interaction, or anywhere in between. And I think it depends on the situation.
Yeah.
And there's not like a roadmap that says, well, if you're in this quadrant, you do this.
That's
if you're
exactly
in this quadrant,
right,
you do this. It has everything to do with not just the scenario of, you know, the timeline you're building within and the people that you're working with, but also like the cost of the tools and, you know, licensing fees.
Host of other variables.
Yeah, there's so many things to consider.
Yep.
And oftentimes we end up just going with what we know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brian, I was talking with our audio guy, and another way to say that thing that I just said about keeping moving forward is within the context of composition and writing music, you know, it's just like, look, you know, you can, when at any point in a song, if you're trying to figure out what to do next and you don't know where to go with the composition, you got two choices. You can do the same thing that you're doing, like repeat the musical phrase for another four bars, or you can do something different. And those are your only two choices.
Yeah.
You can't not do anything.
Yeah. Just truncate the music right there. That's the worst choice.
Yeah.
Because anyone dancing is going to be like, oh.
Unless it's something different. Unless it's like a rest. And, you know, but what you can't do is just sit on your ass and not move forward. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an idea that transcends, like, all creative disciplines, right? Yeah.
I really like the shark metaphor.
Yeah.
You got to keep swimming forward or you die.
Yeah, that's what they do.
Yeah.
Works for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we'll end on that.
All right.
You have moved forward in the last 30 minutes to this point where hopefully you learned something. I know we did. At least I did.
There's like a weird still pun in there somewhere of being distilled. We're not. I'm not gonna do it justice.
It's okay. I'll forgive you.
You get the idea. You said distilled like three times.
I try to.
You
put
said
that.
You said twice actually during this podcast. It was,
it's okay.
I didn't know that was allowed.
It's a branding.
I didn't know.
Subtle.
I don't know if that was a no-no or not.
All right. This has been distilled one more time.
There it is again.
Thanks for listening, folks.